Ovi, everyone! This is Gary, and this is the only show where I, your host, tells you about six tech-related stories and one animal-related story while they have a randomly selected beer! Yes, this is I'll Have a Beer and Talk, except no substitute. This past weekend was a rare treat, a three-day holiday weekend in these United States, so I got to experience my most cherished of days, Sunday 2! I love having an extra Sunday, it lets me catch up on things. Or not. It's an extra day. Do whatever I want. One thing I need to catch up on, though, is getting the show started. So let's give the randomizer a kick and see what falls out. The randomly selected beer made by the randomizer is Golden Road Brewing's Berry Guava Wheat, a 5% ABV fruit vegetable beer. I haven't had one of these in a good long time. A fruit vegetable beer is a somewhat plain beer, usually an ale, in this case an American wheat ale, that has fruit or vegetables added to give it a unique flavor, in this case guava and strawberries. Sometimes real fruit or veg is used in the making of these kinds of beers, although extracts or syrups are more commonly used. I couldn't actually tell what Golden Run used for this, but as long as it tastes good, I don't really care. The maltiness and bitterness of these fruit veg beers is usually kept very low to allow the fruit or veg flavors to take center stage. These are really good beers for hot days when you're just lazing about outside, which I'm going to be doing shortly. It's going to be like 80 today. Woo! Or for days we're just lazing about underground doing audio recording. Let me activate the beer mic so I can taste the rainbow. And now the whole room smells like guava. Wow, that is a very odorific beer. It is kind of a hazy, coppery, goldeny color with a tan head. And like I said, I'm going to taste the rainbow. And my, what a tasty rainbow it is. It's very, very strong of guava, a little bit of strawberry, tiny bit of bitterness and the carbonation from the beer. It's interesting. It's like a bit of a fizzy fruit drink and it's got alcohol in it. So win-win. If you've been around the internet as long as I have, you may have noticed that in electronic environments, communication can become strained. Text-only conversations can easily go off the rails, mostly because all the contextual nonverbal cues our primitive meat brains are wired to notice and combine with the face value of the information we're digesting. Lacking that data path, we rely on how things are written. And let me tell you, there are not a lot of great writers out there on the internet, myself included. And I'm not just talking about flame wars erupting on Reddits. Communication misunderstandings due to how we write can happen anywhere, like in the workplace or even Wikipedia. It'd be great if there was some kind of digital moderator, and that's why researchers from Wikimedia, Google Jigsaw, and Cornell University have been using machine learning to study conversations that go very wrong in an effort to identify certain phrasings that increase the likelihood of verbal fisticuffs, reports The Verge. The researchers pre-programmed their software to identify conversational features that previous research has shown had an effect on a conversational mood. Basically, conversations that contain greetings, statements of gratitude, and lots of please and thank yous are probably going to turn out okay. Participants keep an emotional distance and create an environment where participants feel safe to admit they are wrong if it's warranted. On the other side, repeated direct questioning and quote sentences that start with second-person pronouns, such as "your sources don't matter," suggests a participant is trying to make the conversation personal, especially if such phrases appear in the first reply, which then cause things to go a little pear-shaped. Google's Perspective AI, a tool designed to measure how friendly, neutral, or aggressive text is, was also added to the program to determine the general toxicity of conversations. The researchers utilized a statistical method known as logistic regression to increase or decrease how the program used all that information and started feeding it conversations for analysis. The program was given a pair of conversations, both of which started out friendly, but one of which went south. The program had a 65% success rate in identifying which conversations would go well and which wouldn't, which at first blush seems pretty good. However, The conversations only came from one source, Wikipedia talk pages, which the article points out is where participants are working towards a shared goal, which is way different than most message boards, and humans tasked with predicting how conversations would go had a 72% success rate. However, the researchers believe they are onto something. Humans have nagging suspicions when conversations will eventually go bad, and this research shows that it's feasible for us to make computers aware of those suspicions too. Justine Zhang, a PhD student at Cornell University who worked on the project, told The Verge. As with any AI or machine learning research, one must keep in mind that it's possible the technology can end up being misused, or turn out to be more harmful than useful. The program could be used to steer conversations away from rational political discourse, for example, or defuse situations where some benefit could come from heated discussion. Zhang said they found that, quote, some disagreements are inherently useful, and if the software was too quick to judge, it could, quote, dissuade potentially constructive discussions. Zhang also noted that there are cases of people managing to recover from bad conversations, so deciding when a machine should step in and mediate is an interesting question. It was interesting to see people managing to do this, using some weird combination of being firm and polite. She hopes further research will focus on those types of conversations where people prove to not be so bad after all. Zhang put it quite nicely. Our focus was looking at conversations that derail, but it was nice to see that that's not all that is out there. But if things escalate out in meat space and result in crimes, we have to rely on after-the-fact moderation by officially recognized uniformed representatives of the law. In an effort to investigate what occurred and who was at fault, all witnesses need to be interviewed. Gizmodo says that it's been recognized that eyewitness testimony is much less accurate than we all really want it to be. But researchers at the University of Westminster, London, published a new study in Frontiers in Psychology that suggests that an easy way to improve the witness's memory and recall is by having the witnesses interviewed by a virtual avatar, and not a flesh-and-blood police officer. The university recruited 26 female and 12 male volunteers for the study. They watched a staged video of a car theft, and then were asked to return 2 days later. When they returned, they were interviewed about what they had seen. Half had a face-to-face interview in a nondescript room with a research assistant, and the other half strapped on a virtual reality headset and had a face-to-virtual-face interview in a virtual recreation of that same nondescript room with a humanoid avatar. Both groups were asked the same series of questions used by UK law enforcement when investigating a crime. Both groups were as accurate as each other during the first part of the interview, known as a free recall task, when they are allowed to detail whatever they remembered about the staged crime. The second part of the interview went a little differently. Both groups were asked specific questions about the crime. The face-to-face group got 30 of the details correct during the interview, but the virtual interview group were about 60% better than that, getting an average of 37 details correct, including the color of the thief's jacket. They also provided fewer inaccurate details and had less instances of false memories clouding the observed facts. So why is this happening? Gizmodo spoke with Julia Shaw, a psychologist at the University College London who specializes in memory, and who was not involved with the study. Unlike when we interact with technology, when we speak to humans, we constantly manage the impression we are making, controlling how we move, speak, what we say, Shaw stated via email. This has two effects. First, it takes a lot of effort that could otherwise be used for remembering what actually happened. Second, the nature of a social interaction can affect how and what we remember. A particularly attractive or friendly interviewer may encourage you to mention more details than you are sure you remember, while a judgmental or distracted interviewer may make you keep your responses too short. According to exit surveys, the volunteers who took a virtual trip down to the station to be interviewed stated they had an easier time talking and were more comfortable admitting when they didn't remember. They also stated they were less confident that their memories were accurate than the face-to-face interviewees, but this aligns with witness research. Confidence is not a reliable predictor of memory accuracy, and inaccurate witnesses tend to be far more confident about their statements than more accurate ones. They're usually influenced by other factors such as suggestive police questioning. Now, this was merely a proof-of-concept study, but the team plans on conducting more trials of this interview method. Virtual environments allow interviews to be conducted quickly and remotely, and, our research suggests, more effectively, said study co-author Coral Dando in a statement. It would be nice if our research program starts a conversation about the real possibilities for remote, yet effective, witness interviewing. And I totally agree with the whole concept of remote witness interviewing. Speak from personal experience. But if there were no witnesses, what else can be done to identify a law-breaking guilty party? Collecting sweat is a possibility, just like collecting fingerprints. It feels like just a few months ago, I talked about sweat-based authentication, so this story from The Verge seemed somewhat familiar. In a study published in the journal Analytical Chemistry, University at Albany forensic chemist Jim Halimek and his team took 25 samples of sweat taken from volunteers and 50 samples of artificial sweat made from the chemicals found in sweat, and then analyzed all those samples. Based on the concentration of three chemicals found in sweat, urea, glutamate, and lactate, they were able to tell each of the samples apart from each other. Halimek wants to apply the ability to differentiate between sweat samples to a criminal investigation scene because people are always sweating. And then emphasis is mine. It's easier to find sweat samples than fingerprints. Much like a fingerprint kit, Halimek and his team developed a strip to pick up sweat samples, and they claim they can do the analysis with one drop of sweat and within minutes. Now, our sweat doesn't contain a consistent mix of chemicals. The mix varies throughout the day, but this method can help in determining how many people were at the crime scene. The key is that the levels of chemicals in sweat change in predictable ways. Halimek and his team are now developing a forensic toolbox as they learn how to get more information out of sweat, such as gender, age, and diet. I hope to be able to one day analyze sweat at a crime scene and then say, we are looking for someone who is tall, white, female, in very good physical shape, or an old male with liver disease, he says. So watch out, criminals. The weed of crime bears sweaty fruit. Hey, were you aware that this show's sponsor is Portland's only community handmade papermaking studio? I am talking about Pulp & Deckel, and its mission is to keep the art of papermaking alive with workshops, demonstrations, creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products, and working with artists in creating all styles of art through the medium of papermaking. Browse a rotating selection of papermaking workshops, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, and check out all the amazing things we do with the ancient art of papermaking by visiting pulpanddeckel.com. That is pulpanddeckle.com. And when you get in touch with Pulp & Deckel, if you mention I'll Have a Beer and Talk, we might give you something special. A long time ago, I did a story about the possible existence of hidden rooms within King Tutankhamun's tomb. Specifically, it was back in episode 46. This is episode 118. That was like 72 episodes ago? An eternity. Anyway, I have a follow-up story. So yes, it is time for some Egyptian FU follow-up. Gizmodo reports that, nope, there are no hidden chambers. Inspired by Egyptologist Nicholas Reeves' theory that Queen Nefertiti's tomb was located behind the walls of King Tut's tomb, radar specialist Hirokatsu Watanabe scanned the tomb in 2015 and claimed to detect signs of hidden doors in the north and west walls. And that's the story I talked about. Subsequent scans were performed by the National Geographic Society, and they couldn't replicate the results, so a third effort took place in February of this year of our Google Overlord 2018. Researchers from the Polytechnic Institute of Turin and specialists from private companies GeoStudie Astir and 3D Geoimaging conducted comprehensive scans of the 3,300-year-old burial chamber. They utilized ground-penetrating radar and spent 7 days scanning the chamber, analyzing the equivalent of 1.6 surface miles. Each of the teams of researchers used high, medium, or low scanning frequencies, with low frequencies being able to scan deeper than higher frequencies, but at the cost of resolution. The teams individually interpreted their data, then compared all data sets together, cross-checking to confirm that no, there is no evidence that there are any hidden doors or chambers beyond the walls of the chamber at depths of up to 13 feet. They also attributed Watanabe's findings to that of ghost signals, stray radar reflections coming from in front of the walls, not behind. So, probably disappointing for Watanabe and, by extension, Reeves, but good for the chamber itself. Using radar technology preserves the walls. Without radar, the only way to look for secret chambers would be to drill into them. But I'm sure you know my thoughts. But I'll state them anyway. I think they did find a secret, hidden chamber in the tomb. But the void beyond the wall was, in fact, the prison of Sutek, the ancient Osirian alien whose greatest desire is to destroy all life in the cosmos. So they left him undisturbed to save us all. Hey, what would you say if I told you that researchers had developed a system of reading and writing brain activity using lasers? It's true and cool, and I read about it on Digital Trends. Hillel Adisnik, an assistant professor of molecular and cell biology, told Digital Trends, "We have developed a system using laser light that can both read brain activity and write brain activity. The system uses principles of holography, a method to generate three-dimensional patterns of light that many might be familiar with in holographic displays. The goal of this technology is to measure brain activity in both health and disease so that we can correct aberrant patterns of activity in real time and treat a wide array of neurological disorders. The system could potentially see a buildup of abnormal brain activity, like the signs of a seizure, and effectively overwrite the activity to cause it all to come back to normal baseline. The system is quite clever. An LCD screen displays images to be used as a kind of holographic negative, shaping laser light from 40-watt lasers into custom patterns. The laser beams are pulsed every microsecond in 300 femtosecond long bursts, attempting to match the speed at which neurons fire in a brain's cortex. The writing technique has been successfully tested in mice, too. Mice were bred to have neurons that express proteins when they are hit by light, which cause a brief spike in activity. A half-millimeter square section of their brains were subjected to the laser pulses, and it totally worked." That's kind of awesome. "The researchers are confident the system can be scaled up, and this could potentially create an efficient two-way brain-machine interface, one that could be used for prostheses, for example, providing sensory feedback, or implants to compensate for the aforementioned brain abnormalities, or even allow one to enter the matrix. We plan to use this system to see if we can cure models of cognitive disease such as schizophrenia," Adisnik said. "But as basic neuroscientists, we are also primarily interested in using the system to crack the neural codes of sensory perception. We want to understand how our brain builds perceptions of our external world all through the language of neurons, which is basically a digital code of zeros and ones in hundreds of millions of brain cells. We believe this new technology can address this fundamental question in neuroscience because we can attempt to generate artificial perceptions by writing specific patterns of activity into the brain and see what works." Laser brains of the future! Hey, since I'm talking about mice, let's talk about mice again. Not ones with laser brains, but how about getting mice drunk to test hangover cures? Science! Chemical engineering professor and self-identified wine connoisseur Yongfeng Liu wrote in Fast Company about his efforts in attempting to find a hangover cure using chemistry. "The current treatment for hangovers, and also alcohol overdoses, believe it or not, is usually just letting the body's enzymes break down the alcohol on its own. Liu did not like this and decided to, quote, design an antidote that could help people enjoy wine or cocktails or beer without a hangover, and at the same time create a life-saving therapy to treat intoxication and overdose victims in the ER. Both excellent reasons. He teamed up with the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California's Professor Cheng Ji, an expert in liver disease, and Liu's own graduate student, Duo Zhu, to develop capsules filled with enzymes that are found in liver cells that could speed up the alcohol breakdown process. They decided on using three natural enzymes that convert alcohol into harmless waste molecules, but needed to determine the best way of delivering the enzymes to the liver. They wrapped the enzymes into FDA-approved shell material used for manufacturing nanopills, and then injected the resulting enzyme nanopills into the veins of drunk mice. The pills eventually ended up in the mice's liver, delivering the extra enzymes, supercharging the liver, and decreasing the sloshed mice's blood alcohol levels by 45% in 4 hours compared to the mice who hadn't received the nanopills but were also equally drunk. Not only did the pills enable the mice to process alcohol quickly, but it also kept acetaldehyde levels extremely low. Acetaldehyde is a carcinogenic compound produced during normal alcohol metabolization and is the culprit behind blushing, headaches, and vomiting while drinking. Liu says that they are completing tests to make sure there are no dangerous or unexpected side effects and that the nanopills are generally safe, but if they prove effective in animals, human trials could be as early as 1 year away. Perfect for when I go to Beer Fest next year. And now for something completely different. Mashable reports that researchers at Australia's Macquarie University have possibly gone too far and taught sharks to like jazz. You could say they were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should. Anyway, they published the results of their study in Animal Cognition. Very little research has been done in regards to elasmo branches, which consist of sharks, rays, and skates, and their ability to distinguish sounds and associate specific sounds with specific things. Sharks have been observed reacting to the sound of boat engines, usually being drawn towards them, but no previous study has really tested their association ability. This study involved 8 baby Port Jackson sharks, a water tank, some food rewards, and jazz music. The abstract of the paper didn't exactly say how the experiment was conducted, but I think it's pretty safe to say they played jazz music on one corner of the tank and would give sharks that swam over a tasty treat. 5 sharks out of the 8 were able to demonstrate what appeared to be an association with jazz music and food, swimming over to the source of the sound when heard, even if the journey didn't involve a treat at the destination. However, when the sharks were then presented with what's called a discrimination task, where they have to differentiate between different types of music, they didn't do so well. Classical music was played on one end of the tank, and jazz music on the other, and the sharks appeared to be confused and didn't prefer the jazz over the classical, although a strong bias for whatever sound was coming from the right was observed, no matter what style of music was being played from over there. Interesting. Sharks are right-finned. So, sharks react to music, yes, and can associate music with food, yes. But they don't seem to have a preference as to the type of music, other than the direction that it's coming from. Oh well, I guess jazz sharks were too good to be true. I'll just have to make my own. Hello everyone. Did you know that this show is not only supported by Pulp and Deckel, but it's supported by loyal listeners just like you? If you enjoy the show and want to join in on the fun, I've got 3 choices for you. You can always hire me for some voice and audio production work. I can do voicemail messages, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some adequate audio production. I actively edit and produce this show, and I also edit the Paper Talk podcast. I hope you've heard of it. If you feel you or someone you know might have a use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and my brain, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpanddeckel.com. That is gary@pulpanddeckel.com. Rates are reasonable. And here's an open podcast industry secret. If you rate and review the show on iTunes, the more I have asked discoverability will go up for people looking for beery tech podcasts on iTunes. It shows up as a recommended suggestion, and if I could just reach one more potential listening human brain. Out of an infinite number of human brains, based on that iTunes suggestion, I could center it a win. And as always, you can support the show directly with money. If you enjoy what you're hearing each episode, you can donate at least $1 a month to the show at patreon.com/ihabitradio. That is patreon.com/ihabitradio. Go to patreon.com/ihabitradio and become my patron. You'll be joining a very attractive and intelligent group that already support me there. That $1 goes a really long way, believe it or not, and is deeply appreciated. Thank you all! That berry guava wheat was really, really good. Berry, berry good. Sorry. Well, that means it's time for me to go, because the beer's gone, and I want to get outside. It's a nice day. As always, please tell your family, friends, neighbors, pets, plants, aliens, and sharks about the show, and they can find it on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and on Spreaker. And please send me feedback, story suggestions, and beer recommendations to gary@pulpanddeckel.com, or on the Twitters and Instagram at ihabitradio, or even on the Facebook at facebook.com/ihabitradio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!